Okay, well, we're on the home stretch for tonight, so we're going to try our best to get you the ice cream at 9:30. So, you know, one of the benefits I've received of sitting through a lot of Al-Anon meetings, as I mentioned earlier, is you kind of get sensitized to some of the harm that we cause out there, because amongst ourselves, a lot of these are, you know, kind of, they become, you know, stories. One of my stories was I was a corporate trainee in Louisville, Kentucky, which is how I got there in the first place, way back in the 1973. And I lived in this corporation, had a corporate apartment on the sixth floor of this nice high-rise apartment building. And I had a roommate in one of the other bedrooms at this apartment. And this guy was somebody I didn't like, you know. It was different. He was, best I could describe him in the language of that time, he was one of those goddamn dope-smoking hippies, you know. And his name was Richard, and I nicknamed him Richard Reefer. And he was the antithesis of everything it's just hard to keep my hands off him. And so I came back into that apartment one night after being out and partying a bit myself, and Richard, in his cool doobie self, is kind of out on the balcony with his guitar strumming along, and da 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 da. And I walk in to that apartment, and I just flashed. And what I did is I just quickly strode across the apartment from the front door, and without any conversation at all, I put my shoe and took him over the rail of that balcony and grabbed his legs and hung him upside down, six floors up over the pool apron. And because I'm not in prison, you can guess I managed to pull him back in. I didn't let go of him. And so forth. So I would tell that story from time to time because I couldn't locate Richard. That company's been bought and sold and bankrupt and, you know, gone through multiple things, and there's no tracing of that. And besides, it was just kind of a funny story, and Linda and I were down in Louisville in 2004. Don was doing a traditions workshop down there one weekend, so we went down for that. And we were driving along the Waterson, and I pointed out, I says, "Yeah, that's the apartment where it happened. That high rise over there." And she turned to me, she says, "Oh, I never heard. How did you manage to make amends to him?" And I'm going, "I owe him amends?" Because literally, that was just a funny story up till then. And she says, yeah, "Well, she says, "Well, what happened to him?" And I says, "Well, he resigned from the company, and I never saw him again. He left town." And she says, "Oh, so you kind of terrorized him?" And I mentioned that because there are things like that that, you know, we kind of become part of our little urban legend story, whatever. And, you know, holy shit, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, I see that entirely differently now. And I get to see it regularly because if I stand in the right corner of my wife's backyard, I can see the top of that building, you know. And it's still there, and I haven't found Richard yet, but you know, one of these days maybe I will. But I certainly owe him amends. That's one of those clueless things. See, I did harm in ways that I didn't even get. I thought, yeah, come on, guys will be guys. We just playing with each other a little bit. And she says, well, no, I think hanging somebody upside down 6 floors up is, you know, it's a little more than giving him a wedgie, you know. And so it's, that's the piece of it. One of the things we kind of talked about a little bit peripherally when I was telling you about Jess's story there about making amends to people that have harmed us, and I've got other experience there, but time won't probably allow us to go into that here, but it's there. And how about the ones we shouldn't make? Now, I told you last night that I got fired by my second sponsor because I'm 2 years sober in AA and dating the married gal and sponsoring her 16-year-old and I'm playing cards with her husband and all of that kind of stuff. So after I had my first experience here, it was clear that I needed to make amends to Judy, was her name, and I made an appointment, sat down to make amends to her. And, all the love stuff was long over with by then. And she and Bill had divorced. And so I made amends, and she said strange things. You know, after I got to the piece where she gets to talk to me, you know, she said, wow. It's really, something's happened to you. You're not the same guy I was having that affair with. And she says, and I'm sponsoring a couple of women right now, and I think we need what we have. She says, would you be willing to take us through the steps the way you've been through them? And I thought that was an easy out because clearly I can't be doing that with women. And especially with my track record. And so I said, well, let me check. So I called up Don, and Don said, well, you know, are you, you know, sexually interested in any of these women? I said, well, not currently. And, and he says, well, then I don't see any reason for you not to do it as a one-off. And so I did. It was a fabulous, it was my first experience of that nature. It was fabulous. As I alluded to before, I got to learn so much because I got to hear what powerlessness felt like and is experienced from the feminine side and all these other things. I got a whole new language and an approach to it and helped me understand my sisters better. And that was great. So, before we left that amends session, I says, oh, by the way, do you have Bill's current address and phone number? I need to make amends to him, clearly. And she says, oh, my God. He you know, we didn't come up in that divorce. He knows nothing about you and me. And we've got a child together, and I'm going to be seeing him at weddings and funerals until one of us is dead. Don't do that. You know, and here I was. See, I was already on my AA high horse. I wanted to say that I'd gone and made amends to the gun-toting federal agent for bonking his wife. You know, and what, boy, that was going to be a story. And I got saved from causing further harm. So I just said, look, if you ever, for any reason, change your mind about that, let me know, because I'm willing to. And so that rolled along. And then there's another one, again, in the can't find category, one that I was in the service. Part of my stateside train took me out to Fort Ord, California, and a beautiful place on the Monterey Peninsula. There, I think they've turned it into condos or something now because the land was too valuable. But at that time, it was I went out there for advanced infantry training, and I'm in this training unit, and there was this guy who was different in the unit. And he had an unfortunate physical resemblance to Reichsführer Heinrich Himmler. And so he picked up the name Himmler. And he started getting picked on and harassed, and we'd call it bullied today and all that stuff. And things were, you know, he'd wake up, we'd mess up his foot locker, so he got in trouble on inspections and stuff like that. And somebody left a hangman's noose. He was on the lower bunk. He hung it from the upper bunk, so when he woke up, there's this noose in his face. And generally terrorized. My part in that was I was drunk coming back from the club there and found a small dead shark on the beach, and I put it in bed with him, and that upset him. when he woke up with the shark. I'm sorry. I'm laughing out of embarrassment because it really it seemed cute at the time, but it wasn't. And eventually, what happened was he flipped out. He lost it. And they came and put him in a straitjacket and carted him away and medicated him and never seen him again. And there are no, it was a training unit. There's no permanent records of anybody, who was there changed every couple of months. And so there is no records to go back to about that, no way to trace him. The closest I've been able to come to make amends for that, it was I was at a men's gathering. It was not Alcoholics Anonymous, but a guy was doing most of the presentation on men who'd been damaged and harmed by other men. And so on Saturday afternoon, he says, are there any of you guys that have been hurt by your brothers, other men? And this guy gets up there, and he's obviously got some physical impairment and kind of struggles up front, and he says, I was at the swimming pool late one summer. I know it was late one summer because football practice had started. And I was just a freshman, and these varsity guys got out of practice, and I was there, and they came to the pool, and they were showing off for these girls, and they decided one of the ways they would show off is they were going to play water polo or water beach ball or whatever, and I was going to be the ball. And so they started throwing me back and forth. And what you see, the damage I've got as a result of that. And, of course, his story was longer and in more detail than what I'm giving you, but that's the essence of it. And so the guy that was facilitating this thing, he says, well, if you could get those guys in front of you, what would you want to know from them? What would you want to tell them? And he says, I've never understood. I didn't know you. I didn't know you. You didn't know me. I never did anything to you. Why did you do this to me? And I found myself on my feet, and I went to him, and I said, I wasn't part of the guys that got you, but I've been part of that kind of a mob. And it was my own lack of character. And I knew what I was doing was wrong, but I was afraid if I didn't go along, they'd turn on me, and I knew I couldn't take it if they did. so I participated in what happened. And he and I had various conversations over that weekend, and he seemed to get some comfort. I mean, obviously, that's not a, it's a small, small thing. But I think if we, as long as we stay willing and are attentive to opportunities, like the thing with Joey, that took 47 years. So I don't know. There's a possibility for these amends. I certainly remain willing, and they're a piece of business on my heart. They're not something I've put away and forgotten. So there was the memories of the amends with my dad. I talked about that a little bit today. My dad was my hero. And I didn't know it until after he died. I didn't know it until fairly recently. My father was, my dad reacted to my drinking much differently than my mother did. And I came to find out that my father was an untreated Al-Anon. When my dad was 15 years old, he was a middle brother, and this was in the Depression, and his grandmother died, and grandpa was a drunk, and they sent my dad, 15 years old, to live with grandpa and to manage grandpa and to see that grandpa didn't hurt himself and that grandpa was okay and everything else. So my dad had grown up as a 15-year-old trying to manage an adult drunk. And I didn't have that information at the time, but so it seemed like Dad and I were head to head. And my I told you he was a football big guy. I'm like my mother. My mother was a fairly petite blonde. The football player and the cheerleader, and all of that. And you know, he was a gentleman for all that power. I would come home and he'd say, you know, I'd start swearing at somebody or my mother or kick the dog or something, and he'd say, son, you can't talk to your mother like that. Son, you can't treat the dog like that. And I'd swear at him, take a swing at him. And I'm big enough I can cause a little trouble by then. And instead of just decking me, which he could have easily done, he'd try and restrain me, and we'd end up rolling around the kitchen floor. And I remember one time I'm trying to slam his head into a kitchen cabinet, and my younger brothers and sister are all up, and they're all crying because they're afraid their dad and their big brother are going to hurt each other, and all this chaos going on. And see, later on, Don helped me see this, because I thought my drinking was fine until I got into my late 20s, you know, early 30s. You know, I was just a social drinker up there, and he took me through all this family history. So let me see, you're bringing violence into your home, you're stealing from your siblings and your parents to support your habit, and he went on down the list, and he says, now tell me what description of social drinking that matches. You know, and I got it. See, I'm a terrorist in my own home. I told you, I'd let my mom think, you know, maybe if she didn't write another check, I might kill myself. So my dad, I told you the last time I touched him was in the hospital drunk, and I could feel his disappointment in my arms when he realized what my condition was. And so he passed, and eventually he was way down the amends list, because I had no, it was really hard for me to get to that place with him. And eventually I was home, back in my old hometown at Mom's, for Christmas, and Don's AA anniversary was the day after Christmas, and so I called Don up to wish him a happy AA birthday, and I says, "Don, I'm back home here in Iowa, and I think I'm finally ready to make amends to my dad." And he says, "Well, what do you want from this, Mike?" And I says, "Well, I guess at this point I guess I just want some forgiveness." He says, "Mike, if you want forgiveness, you're going to have to offer forgiveness." And that was kind of the last little piece for me. And so I drove out to the graveyard, and I was thinking, you know, I've still got the ego because I can see the headstone over here. And I'm thinking maybe it'll be good enough if I sit in the car and do this from here, you know, because I wouldn't want somebody to see me out talking to a gravestone or something. You know, they might think there was something wrong with me, and like there wasn't. But now you've taught me not to be a half measures guy, so I got out and I walked over the grave, and I said, "Dad, I'm dropping my end of the rope. You're square with me. And here's the harms that I'm clear about that I've done you." And there was the whole list about them. But in general, one of the worst ones was that, you know, in order to keep my deal going, I did my best to cause trouble between you and Mom. Because if I could get you two fussing with each other, you weren't nearly as focused on me. And all of that. And I finally said, "Dad, I'd like to become aware of what I need to know in order to get the books to balance between the two of us." And I said a prayer and left, and I went back to my mother's place. And when I walked in her house, it was one of those old tri-levels, and I walked down the lower level, and I saw my dad's desk was sitting over in the corner. And I remembered the letters he sent me. You know, part of my, you know, he's this buttoned up guy out of the Depression and World War II, and he never talked about his feelings, and he wouldn't call me up. And, he didn't call me up. I said he thought he was too cheap to call me. What he did is he wrote me letters on legal pads to both sides. And I saw that desk and I remembered the letters, and holy shit, that takes a long time and takes a lot of effort to write a letter like that. It's not like picking up the phone. And so one of my lies blew up. And I went on and on and on, and we don't have time to go through all of them, but one of them that my dad had a stroke when he was 47, and he was never supposed to walk again. And because my dad was a courageous man and an athlete, he not only walked again, he walked without a brace. He kind of had to drag one leg a little bit, but people were stunned at the recovery. But he worked at that the same way that he'd worked at playing football, and as part of that therapy, he started creating sculptures and things out of wrought iron and glass and lead glass and all that stuff. And this was this stroke happened to him in 1966. So benefits were different then. He had a great job with this corporation, but they just gave him 3 years' pay and kicked him out. So we don't need you anymore. Not in that condition. And there was no disability for him. And so at one point, I'm home visiting, and I got my job in my German car at the time. And my dad asked me, he says, "Son," he says, "would you help me put some of these things that I've made in suitcases? Maybe we can go around to some of the furniture stores and craft shops and gift shops. Maybe we can arrange to sell some of this on consignment." And I did it, but I was pissed, and I hated him for it, because I knew he was doing this to put me in my place, to shame me, to got to carry the suitcase in and say, oh, will you please buy our stuff to help our family and everything else? How could he humiliate me like that? That was the story I told myself at the time. And when the lie blew up, it was, oh my God, he loved us so much that even as he was dying, he was willing to go to any lengths to try and see that we had a good life. He loved us that much. He loved us all the way to the finish line. And I think in my heart I always knew that, but I had to be angry with him because I just knew I didn't measure up to that and I couldn't stand in his shoes. So what I do when I don't think I measure up, I got to make you a little smaller. And all those lies died. And I knew, there came a day I knew that my dad and I were square. And it was good. And it's gone beyond there. See, it's a fortunate thing that love isn't like other things. It's not diminished by time. It doesn't rust or go away. It remains. And so I get moments where I get to re-experience love that my dad gave me years ago. See, I'm one of my physical maladies is I'm a type 2 diabetic, and what that means is my body produces plenty of insulin, but my receptors are damaged, so I can't use it. And see, I was never loved enough. I was never cared for enough. I never felt okay enough. And it turns out that I always had enough and I always had an abundance, but my receptors were damaged. And I couldn't feel that love. So through you and through the grace of God, I get those receptors reawakened and that love still real. I went over, I was cutting Linda's grass years ago, one of my little things I did for her, and I took a break from I'd cut the backyard, I was going to cut the front yard, and I sat down, it was, you know, hot, humid, and all of a sudden I remembered being 7 years old, and my dad's been cutting the grass, and he's wearing one of those old wife beaters and a pair of shorts, and he's all sweaty, and I can smell him, and I'm sitting on his knee, and he's rubbing his hand through the hair I had then, and says, yeah, I sure do love you, son. Say what you real, it's real. Just a couple weeks ago, I was showing Les when I was going through all of that stuff, you know. Here it is. This is a postcard of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport in 1955. It's a Quonset hut, basically, with a propeller plane in front of it. And I looked at it, and this is to Master Michael Lorenz. Dear Mike, sure do miss you, big boy. It's really cold up here. Please help your mother. I'll see what I can find for you. Love, Dad. I was always a love child. I just wasn't able to acknowledge it or receive it. And so we have no idea where these amends take us. Now, some of you may, as I was, been in a place where children got harmed. I was... I did not marry her, but I was in a relationship with a gal named Jan for about 5 years. And when I got in that relationship, she had two daughters, 2 years old and 4 years old, Summer and Erica. And they'd been deserted by a real alcoholic father. This guy was a biker. He was violent. The whole story, and the last time Jan and the girls saw him was he came up on them in their car outside a supermarket, and he took a length of chain and smashed the windows out of the car and left them covered in broken glass, and got on his bike and rode off in the sunset. And I arrive, and I'm driving a luxury car, and I don't have a six-pack of beer. I got a bottle of Bordeaux under my arm and a gram of cocaine in my pocket, and I'm wearing a cashmere jacket, you know. But see, all I ate, it looks different, but I'm just an alcoholic upgrade. The package is different, but the goods are the same. And I'm in these kids' lives for 5 years. And because they're, as a matter of fact, Thursday, Jan trimmed what's left of my hair. She keeps increasing the price as there's less to cut. I don't know how that goes. But I thought, since I never lost track of Jan, you know, I thought, you know, I knew I was going to need to make amends to her, but this was going to be a pretty easy deal. I mean, you know, I'd see her all the time. So I went and made the appointment and sat down to make amends to Jan, and I said what we say, and asked her if she had anything to say, and, you know, at this time, I was married and had my stepson, Andrew, and all that kind of stuff, and he'd come into the shop with me. She says, she said, thanks. She says, I can tell you're a good dad. Now, yeah, I'm a good dad. She says, I watch the way you and Andrew interact and how he is around you, and obviously has no fear, and you're a good, loving father to him. I thought, yeah, mm-hmm. And she says, and that really pisses me off. She says, my girls deserve that from you, and you didn't give it to them. And she went on to tell me, remind me exactly how the cow ate the cabbage there. And it was another straight-up dose of reality that I'd managed to kind of fuzz up and frame a little differently. And so where we got to with that was... I said, well, Jan and I got square, and I said, well, clearly I got to do something with the girls. There was harm done there. And they're early teenagers by this time. And so we went back and forth. I don't know if I want you to have anything to do. Not all their memories are bad. We had some good vacations and did some fun stuff and all that. And she says, we might not want to rock the boat there. And so we talked some more. She said, I'll tell you what, if you want to, you can write them a letter. And if they want to have anything to do with you, it'll be up to them. Okay. So here's the letter. And this is the beginning of that experience I shared with you earlier about how we start to... This is my first unconscious experience of how to approach youngsters. Dear Summer, I'm writing to do what I can to set right the harm that I did during the years that I was in relationship with your mom. I've chosen to type this rather than phone for two reasons. First, my handwriting is pretty hard to read, and second, because I want you to have something tangible that you can look at later when life may be treating you rough. To tell the truth, I'm tempted to let things just stay the way they are because your mom tells me that you have some good memories of the time we spent together. Part of me says, why mess with that? The best answer I have is that I love you, and I'm certain deep in my heart, whether you know it yet or not, I've done you harm. I'm sure that you're aware during those years we were together that I was an active alcoholic. They made me put this next part in bold italics. Let me be very clear that this in no way whatsoever relieves me of responsibility for my actions. I used alcohol and drugs because they were the only things I knew that could give me relief from the constant fear I felt. I was drawn to you and the family because I desperately wanted to love and be loved, but I was also scared to death at the prospect of being responsible. Emotionally, I felt like I had one foot on the gas and the other on the brake. I'm sure that it was hard for you to figure out what was real. Is the real Mike the one who wants to love me, or the one who pushes me away? You weren't crazy. I was. You were a wonderful, lovable child, and you had every right to expect consistent love, emotional support, and parenting from me. What you got was fear, chaos, confusion, and abandonment. I want you to know that I didn't fail to give you those things because you were unlovable or undeserving, but because I was a sick and frightened man incapable of giving. If you feel emotionally ripped off, it's because you were. If you feel abandoned, you're not crazy, you were. I know at some deep emotional level, it's hard not to feel that if you were really worthy and valuable, that these things wouldn't have happened to you. Please believe me, this just isn't so. You are worthy and deserving of love, then and now. It was I that failed you. Summer, I hope you'll accept my heartfelt regret for these and the unlisted harms I've done you. Should you ever want to talk about any of this, please give me a call. If I can ever be of any help to you as a friend, I'd be honored. And then P.S., I'm also sending a similar letter to Erica, since I've also harmed her. And there wasn't any response right away. Eventually, a year or so, I got invited to her high school graduation and the party after that, and that was nice. And then that fall, we got word from Arizona that she called her father Bio Dad, and Bio Dad had died an alcoholic death. He died from, he choked to death from esophageal varices on a couch in a flop house with a bottle of vodka in Tucson. And a few days after I heard that news, I got a call from Summer. And she said, "Mike, do you remember that letter you sent me?" I said, "Sure I do." She says, "Well, you know, that was the letter I was always hoped that I was going to get from my dad someday. And since he'll never be able to send it, I think God had you send it for him." And I got a different look at the world of the Spirit. I'm out cleaning up my mess and doing all this stuff, and I get to be a piece of some healing between a man who suffered from our disease and I never knew, and his daughter. And things started to get closer from there on. I got invited to her wedding, and let her tell you where we were then. "Michael, thank you so much for sharing my day with me. It seems like just yesterday you were chasing us around and bopping us with those foam bats." "Those were such great times." She remembered some great times too. "I'm glad you were here to see me all grown up. It wouldn't have been the same without you. Hope your holidays are wonderful. Please continue to stay in touch. Love and kisses, Summer." And Summer and that husband moved to London for his job. And after a while, she became pregnant with their first baby, and she didn't want to have the baby overseas. She wanted to be with Mom, and so she came back, and little Aiden James was born. And I got to be number three to hold Aiden James. And that was sweet. And on and on, and pretty soon his he had a little brother came along and was born. And the family grew, and they came back, and they lived in Chicago, and it was a beautiful deal. And then in 2011, I got a call from Summer, and she said, I got another gift that I wasn't aware of from BioDad. And I says, well, what was that, dear? And she says, well, he had some Native American blood, and I've got this BRCA1 gene, and I've got breast cancer. And so we started down that path, and because her husband had a fabulous job, she got the best of everything up at Mayo, and things turned out great for a while. And then, as it will, the cancer returned. And she went back up to Mayo, and she stayed there for a while, and then the folks at Mayo said, we can't do anymore. You need to go home and be with your family. And so she went back home to be with her husband and her boys. And we got to do some online chat and stuff. And eventually, she's at home, and it's about the end. And she's in her bedroom, and everybody's taking turns to go in to kind of say goodbye to Summer. And finally, her youngest son, Dylan, who was 7 at the time, Dylan says, "Well, I want to say goodbye to Mom." Okay. And he has, "Can I have a cup of water?" And okay, here's a cup of water. And we're kind of watching through the door. And Dylan walked in the bedroom and walked over the bed to his mother and put his finger in that cup of water and drew a heart on her forehead. And then he turned around and came back to us, and he says, "I've just baptized Mom. Would you guys like to, too?" And see, this woman that taught me so much about love have obviously taught her children a great deal about love. And there's a great poem that says, the lion is... love doesn't die, people do. And Linda gave that to me. Love doesn't die, people do. So when all that's left of me is love, give me away. Don't keep me in your heart. Don't hide me in a chest. Don't put me in an album. Let people see who I am and who I was in your eyes, and give that love away and pass it along. So we're all here, and we all travel different paths, and we've done different things and failed to do other things. But it all ends up being about love in the end of the day. There's a thing that I'll share with you later from a guy we like by the name of Henry Drummond. He winds up this essay on the greatest thing in the world by saying, you know, when we're all called, if we are, to judgment, at the end of the day, it's not going to be how have I acted, what have I done, what are they, all this kind of things. It's the question for our, and I believe it, he says, the question in my soul will be, how have I loved? How have I loved? Where did I give it? When did I hold it back? How have I loved? And he said, you know, a sin against love is a sin against worse than anything else in the world. And That's my experience. We're restored to love, and we do it first by loving each other, and I can have compassion for you that you're not, I can't have for myself, and then eventually it occurs to me that maybe I can experience that compassion, and you've handed it back to me. So thank you very much, and let's get to ice cream tonight. See you in the morning.